It's hour number two of Midday with Trey and BK. Brad Kellner is out sick today. We hope he gets well and is able to come back tomorrow. Kevin Dunn is helping out in his place. We appreciate KD for that. Coming up tomorrow at this time, we're speaking with Patrick Ruby. He is with Vice Sports, and he just wrote an article on how historical black colleges and universities may be threatening the monopoly that is NCAA college hoops. It's a fascinating article that he just wrote, and we're going to speak with him about it to find out more tomorrow at noon. Joining us right now, though, on the Bob Steak and Chop House hotline, he is the writer of classic sports films such as Rudy, My All-American, which he also directed, The Game of Their Lives, and also the film that we're talking about today, Hoosiers. He is Angelo Pizzo. Angelo, thank you so much for the time today. How you doing?
I'm doing great. How about you?
Doing very well. Thank you so much for the time. And getting right to it here, in reading the background on Hoosiers, this was something that a story that you had known about for a while as somebody who'd grown up in Indiana. What did it take for you to take that notion, to take that background and really turn it into a Hollywood movie script that was eventually turned into a film?
Well, that could be a 10-minute answer, but I'll try to sum it up as best as possible. That I went to grad school at USC in film and got a job working in the business in the executive ranks. And one of the companies I was working for, after doing this for about 5 or 6 years, told me that asked me if I had any favorite projects. I said, "Well, no one's really made a movie about the special relationship between the people of Indiana and high school basketball." And there's a great story about this small town team in the early 50s that won the state championship. And I thought that would be a good basis for a movie. And they said, go for it. And so I looked around for somebody, a writer from Indiana, because I wanted somebody who kind of understood how people walked and talked and chewed gum and just, you know, behaved and didn't have to do research. And I couldn't find anybody I liked. So I ended up doing it myself, and that's the real short version.
And so the first real step for you after figuring out that you needed to be the one to write this was to go and do the research to see just what encompassed this team. So you actually visited Milan, correct? And you did like 4 or 5 hours of research at the library. You talked to at least one guy who was on the basketball team itself. And what was it that you discovered from that fact-finding mission?
Well, I really wanted to do I was hoping that there would be enough interesting aspects to the players, the coaches, the relationships that I could make a movie out of it. But you know, one of the things that I had learned in screenwriting 101 at USC was the essence of all drama is conflict. So what I was searching out for was some sort of obstacle beside the fact that they were a small town team, that you know, not everybody got along, or there were some, you know, problems to solve in the course of this 2 hours of telling a story. And the first person I talked to was the center on that team, and he said that and I asked him about how, if everybody got along, he said, "Oh, we all loved each other. And coach loved us, and we loved the coach." And I said, "Were there any troublemakers?" He said, "Well, we had one guy who'd show up late for practice, and he ran laps a lot, but that was about it." So I had in mind probably one of the world's most boring movies. So I just decided to take the basic concept and invent the characters whole cloth, and went from there.
And that included the Gene Hackman character, the head coach, of course, Coach Dale. And you had an interesting story involving the casting of that role, because you guys, what really helped this movie to be made was an encounter that you had with Jack Nicholson, correct?
Yeah, well, David Anspaugh, the director of the film, had a relationship with Jack because he worked for the Aspen Ski Corporation right out of college, between undergraduate and graduate school, and had taught Jack and his daughter how to ski. So when we were trying to figure out how to get this movie made, we went to Jack because he had just made a film that he directed called Drive, he said, which was about a small college basketball team in a fictional town in Ohio. And we knew he had a passion for the sport and had made a kind of size film that we're aiming for with Hoosiers. And he thought he could help us maybe finance it or raise money or give us advice about what to do in that regard. So there's a long story attached to that, which I won't go into. And but driving up to Jack's house and meeting him after a night after a party. But ended up leaving the script at his, on top of one of his piles of scripts. And about a couple months later, Dave got a phone call from him and said, "Okay, I just read your script. I like it. I'll do it." Well, we didn't actually ask him to be the coach, but we thought that was too big a reach. But there was a it certainly changed the attitude of our agents toward that screenplay, who really didn't pay much attention to it. In the long run, he wasn't able to pull it off. We weren't able to make the deal because he was in a lawsuit with a major studio at the time. And he had committed the following year to direct and star in the sequel to Chinatown called The Two Jakes. And he told us to take it to Duvall or Hackman, he said, because he wouldn't be available for 3 years. And he said, well, he might be dead within 3 years. So we took it to Gene, and the rest, as they say, is history.
You know, Robert Duvall or Jack Nicholson, I'm sure, would have done a great job, but I have a hard time envisioning anybody other than Gene Hackman in that role. So I guess in a way you lucked out, but it also took a lot of hard work from you guys as well. So congratulations on getting that one settled. Speaking with Angelo Pizzo here, he wrote Hoosiers as well as Rudy, My All American, which he also directed. We're going to ask him about that in just a second. Of course, maybe the best film all time based around the University of Texas. But I did want to ask you about this, Angelo, because the star player in the movie, Jimmy Chitwood, he was played by an actor at the time by the name of Maris Valenis. Just how good at basketball was Maris in real life? Because it looks like he actually had some game.
Well, Maris never played high school basketball. He tried out 4 straight years and was cut every year. And he was 22, or I think he was out of college, but or was a senior in college when we were told about him, and we went up to, he's playing in some Catholic league in north side of Indianapolis, and he just had the right look. And he had one other thing that, an asset, which was absolutely important. He was a great shooter. He wasn't much of a basketball player, but he was a great shooter. He wasn't a good ball handler, didn't move laterally well, couldn't defend. I could see why, you know, he wouldn't be a contributor. Plus he actually had grown since high school another 4 inches, so that was a factor. But he had a pure shot, a beautiful shot, and he just worked out for us.
That would explain why there were so many catch-and-release shots of him with the basketball
exactly
in the movie
right.
Then. Okay. And interesting. All right. Well, speaking of, and I know that this is all in retrospect, but if you had to write a sequel following the life of Jimmy Chitwood after Hoosiers, of course, we're in 2017 right now, but what would be the next step for him after he finished up with his Hickory career?
Well, because this was based on a real person,
mm-hmm.
a guy named Bobby Plump. Bobby went on to star and at Butler University and was a All-American, and he became a professional basketball player, not in the NBA, but when they had leagues or they had traveling teams that were sponsored by gas and oil companies. Like, he played on this, he made a living playing basketball for about 10 years after that, playing for Phillips 76. So I guess it would be something along the line of the next stage would be his college career.
Okay. All right. And do you have anything that you would write out differently 30 years later now, since this movie has been made? Anything that you would do differently with the script of Hoosiers?
You know, there's been a lot. Every time you do something, you pour so much of your life, your time, your energy into something, and you're so immersed in it for such a long time. When you're done with it, you're done with it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really look back and second guess almost anything I've done. I'm in part because I'm so involved in what I'm doing now or what I'm doing next. But if there was a regret, there was the regret is that we couldn't release our 2-hour and 20-minute version, which I think is the best version of Hoosiers. There was just a lot of scenes we had to cut that I think were really, really special. And fortunately, or I'll put the fortunate and then qualify it with unfortunate.
Okay.
Fortunately, we at the 20th edition of the movie release, they did, MGM did a 2-disc DVD and a special edition. And in that special edition were the last 30 minutes that we had to cut from the movie because of, so these are out, these are scenes that didn't make the final cut. We, that's the good news. So anybody interested in checking out what we wanted in can see it in that regard. But the unfortunate thing was we weren't be able to do a director's cut because they lost the negative. So we couldn't match the quality and the look and the sound.
Oh.
To insert it in the film itself. So
yeah, that is a bummer. But is there any one scene that you think of from what didn't make the final cut in the theater version that that you're particularly fond of?
Well, yes, there is. The one thing that I wanted to show was how powerfully strong and important this community was, and how you know it wasn't just the basketball. It wasn't just basketball that brought them together. You know, we didn't ever see what they, who they were and what they did. This was a farming community. Everything around them was based on, you know, their crops and their, you know, the kind of the seasons of planting and sowing and harvesting. And we spent a day doing this harvest scene that I thought was more poetic than anything was in the movie, and showed these people working together, coming together. It was sort of a metaphor for what the basketball team could be, and it was heartbreaking to lose. It was about 7-minute scene, and we hated to see it go.
That's a great metaphor. I'm guessing that it didn't play well with some test audiences, so the studio decided to cut it out, which is a shame. And speaking of communities,
can I interject something?
Please do.
To you and that's actually not the case.
It's not okay.
No. What happened was that we tested a 2-hour and 22-minute version of the film. In our first test marketing experience with Orion Pictures, and the movie tested through the roof. We had the highest test score that Orion had in something like 10 years. And afterwards, in going through what we were going to do from what we learned, we tried to make the case of releasing it at that length. And the president of the studio said, look, he said, we have to take care of our exhibitors. We have to deliver a drama like this in less than 2 hours. And he said, I don't care what you take out. It just has to be under 2 hours. So we had to take it out ourselves. We weren't forced to. And the only reason we took it out is it really didn't move the story forward.
Right.
It was sort of like, you know, it was just a moment, you know, a side moment in the flow of the narrative, which was always driving forward. So, you know, we understood it was sort of a poetic sidelight and not really, we didn't learn anything new about the characters.
Fair enough. That logic makes sense. Speaking with Angelo Pizzo, he wrote Hoosiers, which we're reviewing today, as well as Rudy, My All American, The Game of Their Lives. He also provided the story for the recent film Bleed for This. And, Angelo, this movie, Hoosiers, that is, it was nominated for 2 Academy Awards, Best Supporting Actor with Dennis Hopper. Also, the film score received a nomination. But rather than attend the Oscars, you decided to do something else that night. What was it that you did in 1987 rather than attend the award show?
Well, I grew up in Bloomington, Indiana. My real passion is not high school basketball. It's Indiana University basketball. And it just so happens that at the same night the Academy Awards took place, so was the national championship final. and Indiana had gone to the Final Four, but we expected them never to make that final game because they were playing UNLV, which is number one team in the country. I think they were undefeated at the time, or they lost one, and they were 14-point underdogs in the Saturday game. But then they ended up crushing UNLV and all of a sudden throwing us into a real dilemma,
mm-hmm.
David and I. So we actually had Dennis Hopper walk in to the rehearsals of the Academy Awards with a watchman. You know, remember those old Sony watchmen?
Oh, yeah.
So to see if we could watch the game while the Academy Awards kind of went on. And he said they were just, and nothing worked, too many electronics there. And so that night, David and I discussed what we were going to do. And he wanted to go. I felt, maybe I couldn't decide. I got up the next morning after a sleepless night, and I called him. I said, I can't go. I got to see Indiana play. So we stayed, and we had two televisions on, threw a little party, and we ended up watching the game about 95% of the time. We only looked over at the Academy Awards when our categories were up. So I don't regret it.
Well, it turned out to be a good decision.
By the way, it was because of that that I became good friends with Bob Knight. The next morning in the paper, there was a headline, a local Bloomington paper: the Hoosiers win a national championship. And then on the bottom of the page says, "Hoosiers creators, stay home and watch the game. Not don't go to the Academy Awards." And I'd never met him before. He read that. And he asked one of his assistant coaches, I need to meet these guys. Who are they? Those are special fans.
Wow.
And a long relationship with Bob Knight.
Any good personal anecdotes to share involving Coach Knight?
Man, we don't have enough.
fair enough.
So many.
Well, you know what? Indiana basketball just made a very abrupt coaching change within the last month. Tom Crean is no longer the coach in Bloomington. What was your reaction when you learned that news?
It was time. You know, I compare it, a metaphor would be like a marriage that started off promising, had some very good times, and then the relationship went south. And that was because I'm talking about the relationship between the coach and the fans,
right,
the fan base and the players. And by the time Tom was let go, finally, everybody was pretty much happy. Maybe Tom and his family weren't, but there were no protests from the players, no protests from the fans. It was just a relationship that had grown stale, and it wasn't working.
Fair enough.
And I'm very bullish on Archie, and I think he's done great things since he's been here. And I'm looking forward to new life and a new season that special things are going to happen. But I'm always an optimist when it comes to Indiana basketball.
No doubt. So you're a fan of the college game. I'm not sure how big of a fan you are of the NBA game, but this is a common conversation around these parts, also nationally to a degree. It's what can be done differently to help out both the professional and college games. The one-and-done rule seems to be a central focus here. Is there something you would do different in terms of allowing guys to be eligible for the NBA draft or perhaps allowing them to come back to school if they don't like their draft slot and aren't able to sign with the team? Is there something that you would do different for the good of the game of basketball?
You put your finger on the thing that bothers me the most, and that's basically how there are super teams put together like Kentucky and Duke with one and done players. It's like a rent a team. You're cheering for a uniform and not players, because for example, let's face it, next year Kentucky and all their fans are going to be cheering for five people they've never seen before. I have no idea who these five starters are going to be unless they watch high school games. So, there's something wrong. Also, I hate to say it, but feels un-American that you can't make a living at something you do very well. And there are some kids that come out of high school, they're ready to play in the NBA. Why should they be penalized and not be able to make money at their sport? Or what they do well. So, I think there needs to be some, but the colleges can't be hurt too. I think if you're going to make, I'm not sure about the 3-year rule that the baseball has, but it probably should be an age rule. that that you can go, you can, out of high school, you can go into the pros, or you can go into the D League or G League or whatever is happening. But if you decide to commit to college, you need to go there for 2 years, you know. So, everybody has an investment in it.
And, Angelo, we just had T.J. Ford on, of course, former Texas Longhorn, also played for the Pacers for a while, and he threw out the idea of giving college coaches more time around their players to help with their development, because that is severely restricted in the offseason right now. And if you do want these kids to get better, you know, they're there for the school as well, of course, but they're also there to get better as basketball players. So that could be something else if you do institute an age minimum if guys don't make it out of high school and go pro then, that that's something that could really help out the college game too.
I think TJ is absolutely right. It doesn't make any sense at all. These kids who come in, whether they're football players, basketball players, you can name other sports, but it's a full-time job. And why is it that only the strength and conditioning coaches can talk to them for like 3 months during the summer? And the college coaches only have them for like an hour or two a week. It makes no sense. So, yeah, I mean, this is why the European system, you know, produces players that are so skilled as they do, because they can work year round with their coaches in whatever kind of venue, whether it's a college or professional situation.
All great points from Angelo Pizzo. Last question here, Angelo. Thank you so much again for the time. You wrote and directed My All-American. It's the first film, the only film so far that you've directed, but you did a great job with it. What are some of your fond memories from making that movie and getting to spend time in Austin?
Well, the kind of support that we had from the University of Texas, the Darryl Royal family, the Freddie Steinmark family, the people who understood that we were paying tribute to a special program and a special group of people. It was real honor to do so, and it was a community that we put together. A filmmaking community that I miss. It didn't have a bad apple or somebody who was clocking in for a checkbook. Everybody was in it for the good of the movie. So I had a great time. It really was special.
Angelo Pizzo wrote Hoosiers, Rudy, My All-American, which he also directed, The Game of Their Lives, and he has joined us for the last few minutes here to talk about some of those things. Thank you so much for the time today, Angelo.
You're welcome.
Great stuff there from Angelo Pizzo.
That's good stuff.
Yeah, he an Indiana native, as he talked about. He had some really strong opinions on Indy basketball. I love the fact that he skipped the Academy Awards to watch his team win a national championship.
That was a good interview. That was the best part of it, though. I mean, getting that, and I would have liked some Bob Knight stories. I'm glad you tried.
Yeah, I imagine there aren't too many PG or made-for-radio Bob Knight stories there.
The only time that I just, you know, wanted to grab someone was when Angelo said, it's you know, we need to cut out with this. It's very un-American. So law and the medical industry and the business industry and all these other things, you can't be a maitre d' at 18, okay?
Right.
There's a lot of jobs. Stop with this un-American stuff. You know what's un-American? Not letting the business decide, as long as it's fair, decide how they want to build their business. And when I say fair, not 18, 19, 20-year-olds, not letting them be a part of your business, that's fair. And you see it everywhere. That's American.
I agree. And we are celebrating today's NBA draft, not necessarily by trying to talk about guys that we really don't know a whole lot about or guessing where they're going to end up.
Monk's going to be the next Scottie Pippen.
We're talking Hoosiers. We're talking to the writer of Hoosiers. We spoke with T.J. Ford in the 11 o'clock hour. And coming up next, we're talking to another Longhorn basketball legend. Lance Blanks is going to join us to share his draft day memories as a player and as a member of the NBA front office. You're listening to Midday with Trey and BK right here on the Horn. Back here on Midday with Trey and BK, minus BK because he's out sick. Some wonder whether it has to do with him putting his mouth too close to the fleshlight a couple nights ago. I don't necessarily think it's that. I think it's more about the terrible diet and the sedentary lifestyle the guy leads. Just leaves him open to contracting illness. He will hopefully be back tomorrow, though. We hope nothing but recovery for our good friend Brad Kellner. In the meantime, Specs text line is 337-3776. Here the dog writes in, man, these stories associated with such an iconic movie are fascinating. Good get, Trey. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Somebody else says, because I did mention assuming during the interview with Angelo Pizzo, that you know what happens when you assume, Trey. Makes an ass of you and me. No doubt about that. Somebody else asks if BK suddenly hit puberty or if KD is filling in a much deeper voice. That is true, and Kevin was filling in. We appreciate that. He just had to go take off to finish a couple of errands before the afternoon show with Chad and Kevin takes place from 3 to 7 today. Left Testy says NBA has to use the MLB draft model or something similar to that. I feel like that's where this may end up heading. That if you are good enough out of high school to make it happen, then an NBA team will take that chance on you. Otherwise, say you are drafted out of high school in the second round or whatever, but you can't make the financials work or you realize that you're not quite ready yet, you do need to go into college for a set amount of time. I don't know if it's 2 years or 3 years. People have differing opinions on those things, but I do think that a system like that is much better than the current system of one and done. KD with the groan, somebody else says on the Specs text line. Yeah, he did give a groan when Angelo was talking about the heart of the American way having to do with giving people opportunities with things. The point Kevin always makes is, look, if you go to a law firm or an engineering firm, there is an education that's required before you can get a job with that company. Why should public opinion dictate how a business runs things? Unfortunately, in the NBA's case, it's the business is the one that is responsible for making these rules, as is the union responsible for protecting guys who are already a part of that company. NBA Players Union did itself a disservice by not insisting on protecting guys who are established veterans versus giving guaranteed money to a lot of guys that still have huge question marks coming out of, what, a year of college? But that was the transition from not having any sort of rule in, requiring a guy to go to school for at least a year. It led to the Texas Longhorns getting Kevin Durant for 4 months. And it has also led to a lot of guys in that ilk who were not nearly as good as Kevin Durant, haven't made the name for themselves that Kevin Durant have, but also left Texas basketball after a year or two, or now are playing in very obscure leagues someplace outside of America. So it is a two-way street, and I think a lot of the players who have tried to capitalize on the idea of going to college for a year or two and then skipping out to go pro, I don't know if they're regretting that necessarily, because I'm sure there are a lot of positive things to be had from experiencing the culture of a different company. But it seems like a lot of American kids, the ultimate goal is not just playing professional basketball. It is playing in the NBA. That's what we all watched growing up. That's what we were all envisioning whenever we're sitting in our driveway or on the playground lot shooting buckets or driving in for sweeping layups, as I was inclined to do as a fat child who wasn't even close to being able to dunk the basketball. T-Bone says, I played baseball for Del Valle. Oh, this is speaking about Kevin and I talking about dealing with losing in sports. I played baseball for Del Valle. We took ass kickings like champs, mostly in football. Westlake and Reagan usually thumped us pretty good back in the day. And no doubt that helps you build character, T-Bone, because that's what losing does in sports. A lot of us are bad losers when we first start out in sports. Some remain bad losers over time. We all remember the rec league honchos who are kicking the ball whenever things don't go their way. This is talking as adults here. I still run into this Not trying to talk sand volleyball right now, but it's a sport that I still play. Occasionally, I will run into the person who literally kicks the ball away when something doesn't go right for him. It's pathetic. And quite frankly, for us as adults now, who a lot of us have learned how to deal with the positives of winning and the perils of losing, that person doesn't get invited out a whole lot more because that person is not fun to play with. Because even when they win, they're sore losers as well. As kids, a lot of us are one or the other, and hopefully over time, most of us learn to deal with the losing a little bit better. Zach, are we still short on Lance Blanks? All right, we're efforting Lance Blakes right now, hoping to speak with Lance to get his perspective as a former NBA player and also a front office executive on some of the fond memories he has from draft day. In the meantime, I guess let's go ahead and shoot some bull right now,
Shooting
Zach.
Shooting the bull.
Every day at about 12:30, we do pay ode to the former show known as Shooting the Bull. It's how Brad and I got our start on this radio station as co-hosts. And so now we take the opportunity every day to talk about some sports-related things, others that aren't as sports-related. And we're going to start today, guess what, Zach? We're going to start in the world of soccer. As much as I make fun of soccer, the first story coming from Deadspin does talk about soccer. Apparently, a field mic during the Mexico-New Zealand Confederations Cup match yesterday caught the Mexican coach calling someone an MF-er, but he said it out. He said the whole thing out, of course, and this was on television. My thought to this is, you know what, I think this is a step in the right direction because at least we don't have someone associated with Mexican soccer throwing out a homophobic slur at this point, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the problem here with the Mexican national team is that they're always being accused of doing that homophobic slur. And despite countless efforts for them to try and get the fans to stop it, nothing's going to help. That's just so rooted in that soccer culture in Mexico.
Well, I had somebody, because I tweeted this story out a little bit earlier. You can follow me at Courtesy Wave on Twitter. You can follow Zach at Soccer Is a Sport. And I'm guessing I'm having to accept that it is a sport, at least for the next few minutes while I talk about a soccer story.
Yeah, you can't be talking out of both sides of your mouth.
So I had somebody when I tweeted this out, say that the whole PUTO, I guess, is the part that would get me in trouble.
The
thing
spelling
is being misinterpreted. The phrase is not the literal translation. So I asked her, what is this then? And she says it depends on the context. It could be MF-er, it can be S-head, it can be dumbass, it can be idiot, sissy, bro. In the context of Mexican football, it's just a way to distract. And so I ask, well, obviously there is a literal translation that comes out to a homophobic slur. So what is the literal translation of this word? I'm like, is it something like gay? Is it like the word fag that some people use in a very derogatory manner that is incredibly ignorant, but it's still how some people choose to use when trying to describe something negatively? And she says it's more like the B word, that people have been looking up the word and have been taking it literally. So I said, well, what is the literal translation then? And she says it's like a man whore, like gigolo, I guess.
Mm.
But I can't really envision saying, oh, you gigolo, like trying to put somebody down by calling them a gigolo.
Soccer culture is very strange, but that's part of the thing. And it's that chant is slowly finding its way into American soccer stadiums, and it just needs to stop. I mean, no matter what you're saying, I'm going to sound like such a wimp right now. But if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all. Just say another word to distract him. If that's all you're trying to do.
I don't listen to you a lot and say, oh my gosh, I forgot my producer's a millennial. But that was a very millennial.
That was a millennial at moment, I
but
know.
But you're right, though. I mean, I'm making fun of this participation trophy culture and the fact that we can't even have some friendly trash talk towards one another. But in that situation, if you're going down the derogatory insult term to where it's discriminatory, to where it's maybe either sexist or homophobic or racist, then you should probably avoid that. I don't care what the language is or what the interpretation can be conceived as by somebody who's obviously in support of it.
So I have a story for Shooting the Bull. I know I don't usually contribute to this, but would you like to hear what came across my news feed there on Twitter?
Let's hear
a while
it.
Ago? A French Instagram model has died after a can of whipped cream exploded and went into her chest.
What?
I know, right? I didn't think that was a problem, but apparently it's a really big deal.
Do you have any details on this?
Yeah, so she has 165,000 followers, and she posted, or I guess her family posted, that they're grieving right now, and that they're warning people that there's lots of, I guess it's a part of the whipped cream canister, the siphon, and they fail all the time. It's apparently a huge deal, and they're warning people that if you have the canistered pressurized whipped cream, that maybe you should throw it out and find another way to get your whipped cream.
Oh, man, what a terrible way to go.
I know. There's good ways to go and there's bad ways to go. That's definitely not how I want to go.
I used to joke back in the day when I was in my early 20s that I wasn't going to make it much past 30. I was drinking a lot at the time, so please understand that when I say this next part. But I always envisioned dying like on the ski slopes, like after a good day of skiing. There was like a keg explosion or something, and that's how I go. I used to glorify that because I was a stupid drunk at the time versus the stupid sober person that I am now. But the exploding keg would have been a much better way to go than the exploding can of whipped cream.
Yeah, and I mean, it's just a sad story, and I guess it's bringing attention to a problem that I'm sure not many people thought was an actual problem.
I mean, how many people a year are dying of whipped cream can explosion accidents?
You know, it doesn't say in the article, but I'm sure that it's higher than we'd think, I'm sure, if they're saying that it's a big problem.
All right, back to the Specs text line now. Thank you for that, Zach, your addition to Shooting the Bull. I think that'll be it for Shooting the Bull today. Somebody is suggesting next week's movie has to be football, Friday Night Lights or Varsity Blues, perhaps. Actually, next week's movie is something not related to the big three sports. So we started out with a football movie. With the program. Last week we went with Bull Durham, which is baseball, of course. This week we went with Hoosiers. So the fourth week
soccer?
In this rotation, it is the wild card. So it can be an alt sport like soccer.
Ooh.
Or hockey or something that I don't necessarily consider a sport. We'll still call it a sports movie for the sake of the summer movie series. Something like golf or bowling. And there are plenty of movies that Brad Kellner has not seen before. That's what this is all based around. So assuming he hasn't seen it, we're open to suggestions right now. You can text those in on the Specs text line, 337-3776. Please go ahead and text those in. We'll keep Friday Night Lights, which I have not seen as a matter of fact, or Varsity Blues in mind for the following week when we go back to the football movie. But in the meantime, we're looking for a movie about one of those other sports that we should make Brad Kellner watch and then review next week, as well as hopefully speak with someone who is related to the filming. I know Hair of the Dog. I said, quite frankly, again, I say that way too much. It's one of my crutches. Just understand that right now I am by myself. It's Midday with Trey. For right now, because BK, he's out sick. Kevin had to go run some errands before the afternoon show. So right now, it's Zach Christo and I right here on the horn, and we'll be back for one final segment on Midday with Trey and BK. This sounds like the music from the final scene of Hoosiers where Jimmy Chitwood does make the shot. I'm guessing that's what it is. Zach is on the phone right now, so he can't tell me for sure. Final segment here on Midday with Trey and BK. Specs text line is filling up with movie suggestions for next week. A lot of people are saying The Big Lebowski. We may have to go with that one, assuming Brad hasn't seen it. Joining us right now, though, for a couple minutes here on the Bob's Steak and Chop House Hotline. He is another Longhorn basketball legend, and he joins us now as a former, not only UT player, but also a former NBA player and front office executive to share his memories on draft day. Lance Blanks joins us right now. Lance, how you doing today, man?
Doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you, as always, for joining us, Lance. You were a part of my favorite era of Texas basketball from my childhood, the BMW days, and so it's always a pleasure to get to speak with you. And you were selected towards the end of the first round, 26th overall, in the 1990 NBA draft. What are some of your fond memories from that day?
Well, it's just exhilaration from all the hard work. You know, you think about through the years, parents shuttling you all over town and competing against people around the city, the state, the country, and on draft day, I mean, just all those memories flood your head because, you know, at least on that day, being drafted as one of the, at the time, I want to say 58, 60 best players in the world, that's just a great feeling.
Were you actually attending the draft in person? Were you back home? Where were you when you received the news that the Pistons were taking you?
No, I wasn't actually. I was at home at my dad's place, and you know they have what they call the green room. I wasn't a green room guy, and probably preferred to be back home in Texas. And you know I had a sense of who might take me. I knew it would be probably either the Lakers or Detroit. In Detroit at the time, you know, bless his heart, Jack McCloskey, who recently passed, was general manager at the time. He told me if I was there, he'd take me. But, you know, I'd also heard rumors from guys that, hey, you know, sometimes teams tell you that and it's not real. But Jack said it, you know, even through the process when I visited there, as well as during the pre-draft camp in Chicago, they told me, you know, hey, doesn't matter. If you're there, we're going to take you. Just know that. You know, at the time, the Pistons were arguably one of the best teams in the league year in and year out, and had just won the title. So he made good on his promise, and I was available, and they took me. So extremely, extremely excited, and it fortunately took place at home in Houston.
Cool, and as you mentioned, the Pistons were the defending champs at that point in time. They also had a reputation as a team that was tough as nails and not afraid to mix it up, which was also your reputation coming out of UT. Did their reputation worry you at all, or because of the type of player that you were, you're like, hell yes, this is the type of guys that I can get along with?
Well, you know, it's funny you say that. More the latter.
Okay.
I felt confident and comfortable getting along with those guys. And at the time, as everyone knows, Chicago was on the rise. And it was a little bit of mixed feelings, though, because I was I'd made friends with Michael Jordan and had watched him and just really had, you know, positive thoughts about him. But I also felt like the competition, that being the Pistons, was a good fit for my style of play. And, you know, I grew up in Texas, so you know, you come out of your mother, or at least I did, doing the Heisman almost because my dad played, and so being a tough guy was never a big deal for me. And so, but you know, I went through that rites of passage with those guys. In fact, early on, first practice or two, I had a couple of run-ins, and from that day on, I truly got a lot of respect from all of my teammates. I still occasionally I'll talk to them. Joe Dumars I don't think I have hardly anyone as close as I am to him, having spent time there with the Pistons. So it was just a great, great experience in being drafted there and then having the time that I had there with that team and organization.
Talking to Longhorn basketball legend Lance Blanks about some of his memories from draft day. Of course, Lance, you not only went through this as a player, but also as a general manager. What do you consider to be your greatest success and perhaps a move that you tried to make that didn't quite work out on draft day?
Well, you know, I have a lot of experiences from a front office standpoint because, you know, I did it in terms of scouting and, you know, being the director of scouting in San Antonio and the support staff. And then I did it as the one making the decision, you know, in Phoenix. And then so I've had a breadth of experiences, and just, you know, off the top of my head, since I didn't know exactly what questions would come my way, you know, one of the big ones to me, honestly, was Daniel Gibson. And at that time, I was an assistant general manager in Cleveland. And Daniel, he was a little under the radar because he had a spotty season where he had some solid success, but he had some moments that weren't incredible as well. And so he kind of fell under the radar with teams. And we brought him in and worked him out. I think we were his second or third workout. And he had just an amazing workout. And just because of my connection to UT, I had a lot of information I felt that other teams didn't have. And so because of that information, we were able to organize ourselves in a way to get Daniel. I think he was at the 42nd pick. Fast forward a year or two, and Daniel shoots us into the finals with his exceptional shooting during the run in 2000. I think that was 2007 in Cleveland when we went to the finals. So that would have to be near at the top of the list. And then as far as not getting things done, you know, there's a player too little known now at this point where we had some deals on the table to get some second round picks that they kind of slipped away, and I wanted to get them. We wanted to stash in Europe and eventually bring back to the States. But, you know, it happens. It's a lot of people on the board. There are a lot of deals being made literally as we speak through the draft. So it's a very arduous, challenging, and sometimes complex process when you're in that draft room having to make decisions about who you should take.
Absolutely. Last thing here for Lance Blanks, Longhorn basketball legend. Lance, this is a big topic of conversation nationally and around this radio station right now. The current state of the NBA and college basketball as it applies to one and done. Do you like the one and done rule? Do you think it should be modified? And if so, how?
I do not like the one and done rule because I just don't think it. I think it's, you know, not to be cliche-ish or corny, I think it's un-American. And what I mean by that, I think we all should have the opportunity to make money when we so desire, you know, beyond state and federal laws about kids going to school and how many hours or weeks or days they should be in school, be it homeschooling and otherwise. Beyond that, when it comes to the industry of sport, if someone is good enough and someone else wants to pay them for their services, they should not be denied that any more than I would be denied if I graduated from high school and I wanted to start selling fruit for a living on the side of the road or at a beach, or if I had a great idea as a tech guy in college and I just wanted to sell mail order computers because I thought, you know what, I think I can turn this into a pretty successful business. And, you know, I don't have to say any names there in Austin. A lot of people would know who that is. So I don't think an athlete should be denied that opportunity either. You have a very short window, I can attest to that, to play sport. I mean, you get only so many jumps, so many runs up and down the court, and then your time is over, and you've got to, often for guys, you've got to start all over and figure out a way to get in another industry, often with a chunk of change in the bank, but it's not easy come post-career. So I don't think it should be denied. I think, maybe it sounds a little radical, but I think it should mirror other areas of society. And that being, you know, if you want to take the risk, if you want to either go to college, do the one and done thing, whatever the case may be, you should have the freedom to do that, because I think that's what our nation is all about, and that's what it was built on.
Thank you very much, Lance Blanks, for sharing your thoughts on not only the one and done rule, but also your memories on draft day, getting drafted by that defending champion Pistons team, and just also what that whole process entails as a member of an NBA front office too. Have a great day, Lance. We'll talk to you again soon.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on, and should be a great draft tonight. But I appreciate it being on, and hook 'em horns.
Hook 'em horns. Lance Blanks, one of the crucial members of that BMW team from the late 80s into the 1990 year. Thank you very much to everybody who joined the show today. Kevin Dunn, of course, who filled in for Brad Kellner, who's out. TJ Ford started things off at 11. We also spoke with Angelo Pizzo, writer of Hoosiers, also wrote and directed My All-American, and then, of course, Lance Blanks just now. Thank you also to Zach behind the glass for doing a great job of producing, as always. We will be back tomorrow from 11 to 1 for another episode of Midday with Trey and BK. Until then, have a good afternoon. Like that,